Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're so excited to bring you all another season. But first, we're happy to also welcome a new sponsor to Business Second Opinion, Guayaki. They brew an enlivening beverage from naturally caffeinated and nourishing leaves from a species of holly native to South American Atlantic rainforests. It contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. Even the Pasteur Institute and the Paris Scientific Society concluded in 1964 that it is difficult to find a plant in any area of the world equal to mate in nutritional value, and that yerba mate contains practically all of the vitamins necessary to sustain life. On top of that, they support community and ecosystem regeneration, bringing together art, music, and celebrations in many locations. Find them in the City of Angels in October and stay up to date on their events at guayaki.com. Let's hope you will check out this great beverage with your friends and family, and please let us know what you think. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice, ones you may not know you need to be asking, but we believe you should. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion. As you know by now, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So, Carol, let's give the people a little taste of what's in store for them today.
Well, I thought we might examine a question that I think is at the core of business itself, and it underlies so many conversations about and in every business. And that's the question of value. What does it mean? How do we get it, or how do we give it? How do we know if we are getting or giving it and whether we're making it? So it's kind of about assessing value. And let's throw in there values.
So this is a pretty big question for everyone from investors to brands to consumers, as well as socially responsible businesses. But I don't think they all mean the same thing when they say value, probably. So I wonder, is that actually part of the conversation? And for that matter, who has the best yardstick for value? Or maybe, how do you even build a yardstick that everyone can agree on?
Yes. Well, that is the way the largest number of business decisions approach this question. Is it quantifiable? Is it measurable? I thought we might take it on, instead of going directly at that, at what you might call a meta level, a meta question, like, how does the idea of value affect how people run a business and do business in the world?
So the article you picked is pretty interesting, and it looks to be seeking to redefine Maslow's hierarchy of needs into a hierarchy of value. So for our listeners, it's pulled from the Harvard Business Review September 2016 issue. And the title of this article is The Elements of Value by Eric Almquist, John Senior, and Nicholas Block. And to be honest with you, going in, I was a bit skeptical as it didn't really seem very original. How about you, Carol?
Well, yeah, I had a pretty similar experience of it. And one of the things I realized is that we use processes all the time here on our podcast that really try and put a discerning mind to work. And that this article was great for educating people how to do that on almost every framework we use to do that. And we could use it today to help build better living systems, critical thinking skills. In fact, I started doing that as I was reading, and I suddenly realized I had over 30 pages. I was writing a book, and I had to back up.
It's funny because I did notice they put forward this idea of providing a model suggesting it could be used by any and all businesses to design products providing new combinations of value. They even called it a rigorous model, if I'm not mistaken. But the idea of using the scientific method here, I think, actually looms large behind what's evidenced by business scoring systems used to assess how well their model improved performance for a company in terms of loyalty or repeat buying and other performance measures. It's really enticing to show how their model matched up, but I could also see what dropped out once you build a model and everything was essentially a priori assumed to be in the model and you just essentially had to provide it.
Zach, you're pointing out one of the reasons I actually love Harvard Business Review to examine how businesses think and how they're instructed to think by business schools and consultants who are one of the primary contributors to the journal. HBR is primarily a journal which provides a way to present models that consultants develop that speak to categorizing human activity, and then further, how they can make money or help, in many cases, gain power over them. And then they propose a new solution in the article that's a package program that they hypothesize, because usually without proof, that it fits all people for all time. It's the source and the driver to find a better model that these articles are about. It's the drive, in fact, for research and finding the best definition of categories we can put people in that drive much of it. So there are so many important questions that get ignored because of the idea of models themselves.
At Business Second Opinion, as our listeners will know by now, we work to increase your and our capacity to let go of model-driven business thinking. We also see that as quite damaging, honestly, that kind of thinking to our role with the planet and to one another, frankly. And so to be able to think from a discerning mind is how we really want to be looking more deeply and less abstractly at these subjects, which actually models always make everything abstract. So, but Carol, what's the difference here in practice that we can start to highlight for folks?
Well, let me remind people of an example they've started to track, and people send me notes and are saying, give us the next piece of the story. So a few years ago, when I arrived at Seventh Generation, they were using buyer categories into which they added many demographically determined categories and also pulled forward what might be found here on the self-transcendence level of their model. Since they were green, they wanted something that was beyond the person, which this article is claiming is important. And of course, we would agree. The authors think they have done that by creating and making it a needs category. But still, it's the same problem that all categorization has.
Yeah. So buyers become abstractions made up by lumping them into what seems like similar enough groups and in a small number of categories so they can work with them and not have to take on making bespoke household personal care products for every single individual person, which to some degree makes sense. But what drops out is that you don't really know them as living beings or families as communities, but as a segmentation of a whole. So Carol, what did you do with Seventh Generation that stopped this categorization?
Well, I will answer that question, but let me first speak to the effect that that categorization was having. The effect was it required them to do tons of consumer research to try and understand these people who were now in categories who counted on them, and to figure out what the categories were and what the specifics were. And it was done by a firm who researched for other consumer products and personal care product companies. And that happened because they were seen as expert pretty much on the same questions. And in fact, the questions they were asking people like P&G. Well, when you ask the same questions, you get back a lot of the same answers. So they would give these generic answers to the questions they were asking, generic questions, and then they would hand them off to the marketing department in Seventh Generation who commissioned these. Then what happened is those folks would translate the generic answers to the generic questions into generic insights, and they would send them to a few decision makers. But what do you think the effect of all of that was?
I would assume first and most obviously, the answers they get are the same as the ones that their competitors use. So research is so generic now that it's often published for the entire industry. What you get is a kind of spread of this pre-digested form to eventually company employees who actually have no connection to the questions or the people to begin with. So this turns into, at the work level, a set of delegated, segmented, and objective list of assignments that people execute during the workday. But they don't relate to the customers, users, or consumers. And your supply system, which includes distributors running a warehouse or even a distribution center, they're just a box to them. And so if you're going to use a regenerative approach, the first rule of living systems is to see each entity as alive.
Yeah. So now let me answer your question about what we did at Seventh Generation, because we can see we got to have something better because it gives you no ability to differentiate yourself. So what we did at Seventh Generation, and by the way, also at Colgate in Europe and Africa, is really pretty radical. But we dropped out all of that research, all that categorization, and we connected every person in any business of seventh generation directly to the people who use their products and services. So you're thinking, we must call them all up, everybody who buys. Well, what we actually do, and we've spoken about this on previous podcasts, is we create teams in which everyone in the organization is responsible and belongs to one of these teams, is responsible for knowing, not by surveys, but by engaging people with their lives. Now, at the first level they're engaging is the distributor, because if you can't understand the distributors you're working with, and then the consumers, you're working again with generic stuff. So we begin to have them work directly with creating understanding and ongoingly joining the conferences these people join, engaging in the articles they read, the people they talk to. In other words, they were not having somebody else translate and intermediate about what was going on in their lives. And we got rid of the categories that made people think they knew what people needed, but it wasn't really even a good, solid source, and it brought no innovation and creativity in the design because they were abstractions.
And if I recall correctly, they ended up growing revenues from 35 to 65% a year, which far exceeds the research models put out by what Bain had noted, for example. But more importantly, people making the products had a connection to, and therefore meaning from, the responsibility they felt to their buyers, which is powerful. This connection is completely lost when organizational leaders use only data from marketing firms, consulting firms, and then translate all that into assignments for their worker bees. That actually seems to be the biggest loss of all.
Boy, I can't agree more with you. I mean, we know how many people hate their jobs and can't make much sense, and how much delegation gets in the way of all that. But in fact, the teams in seventh generation, those in Colgate Europe and Africa, were discovering specific capacities that overlap with some of the ideas that are on their pyramid rather than having them in categories. And there was a more synergistic way to see it. So, for example, they talk about at the bottom the kind of functional emotional connections. Well, what seventh generation worked with was a framework on function, being, and will that had them experience the people and how they were thinking, what they were doing, that were in their market, not a generic idea about what personal care and household products were. And they dropped out that mechanical process that the marketing consultants had given them and making the people entities, which were categories. And instead, they really began to understand the people they wanted to serve. So they were able to create innovation beyond that, even beyond the consumer and the customer, innovation in ecosystem health, in community development, in family and organizing experiences, which were integrated within the walls of the company and the consumer they were working with. They were not looking at which box to tick. So how does that happen in your business, Zach, or does it?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately for us, we're still small but mighty, so we don't have a real need to overcome lots of layers of fragmentation at this moment. But we do have the beginnings of what you've called in the past field teams that are associated with different buyer classes. We all are in regular communication about ensuring we're rigorously involved in the lives of our ongoing clients, focused on their respective industries and their endeavors within them.
Yeah, and they're your real customers. They're not some classic, we use the word class too, but you have specific people in mind when you're doing that. I know that.
Exactly.
I think it'd be helpful. I've been talking a lot. How would you summarize the exploration we covered so far on how it is you make sense out of the value and who you're checking with to see what the value is?
Yeah. So I think the takeaway for me is we need people connected to the lives they're affecting and serving. All categorization breaks that connection, making them artificial and generic, and thus taking the meaning out of the entire process. But also, it leaves no real spaces for innovation. The crazy thing is that the companies you're talking about gain meaning, human, and life connection while also getting the performance measures of loyalty and financial growth. The authors of this article, though, are not very complete in what they measured, including leaving out the effects inside of the workers, which are the real source of performance and growth. They did not measure innovation, which is also a bit disconcerting here. So, in short, avoid models and categorization of life. It allows you to get more effortlessly to what they purport are these higher order values in the article, near the top of the pyramid, than a method of driving from these fragmented categories. How's that sound, Carol?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And we're going to pick this up in part two and give people a better way to look at what else they can do and how they can keep avoiding categories when they work on value and values. If you're a business, we want to invite you to join the Regenerative Business Development Community, where people are applying these living systems principles we bring to you all the time to look at what regenerative strategy, regenerative leadership, and regenerative work design or human development are really about. We have over a dozen companies in each community we start up again, and it's a great place to learn more about what regeneration really means. There's another way to do that, and that is to submit your company to the Regenerative Business Prize process. You can nominate yourself. You can get help from one of our resources and nomination. And as you go along, you will be being educated after you make it through the first round in how regeneration works, and you'll be able to apply that to your business. So please, if you'd like that free education and some reflection from our panel of amazing jurists who are working with a rubric of the seven first principles, then go to the website, the Regenerative Business Prize. It's also on the Regenerative Business Summit website, which you can move over from there. And submissions just opened this week and are open for a couple of months. So download the rubric from the prize page and learn more about how it is you can nominate your company and jump into a bit of free learning in the process. There are many other ways to join us, from the books that I write. A new one will be out shortly called The Regenerative Life. And we have several communities there for women. Well, one of them is for women. And go check that out under my website. Go to carolsanford.com and then follow down till you find Seed Communities. Or you could just go straight to seedcommunities.com and find out about the Regenerative Women Entrepreneurs Group. I do want to thank all of you for joining us, and especially to our sponsors, Guayaki, and people who send in a question, and we're able to use that to develop, and particularly if you send us an article, we will send you a mug that says, "Get a Second Opinion." It can hold your favorite hot beverages and cold beverages. And if you want to get a second opinion mug, you send your topics or your articles and practices you'd like to have us review to carol@businesssecondopinion.com. And find us on Twitter at biz_second_opinion. And if we use it for an episode, you will get a mug from us. Please also go add your rating and reviews on any platform you find us and help us spread the word. You can also sign up for our newsletter so that you can get the connection to the show notes and much more about what events are coming up. And by the way, thanks to Numi Tea, they sponsor our show notes and the Regenerative Business Prize as well. Check out the Business Second Opinion website for more information on all of those. And we'll see you next time.